This is the Bill Kelly Show podcast.
Hamilton Councillor Donna Skelly has apparently ended months of speculation saying that she's going to be seeking the Progressive Conservative nomination for the new riding of Flamborough and Glenbrook. That's to the surprise of not a whole lot of people, although there are some that suggested that there was a promise made that she wasn't going to do that. So to try to get some clarity on this, we are pleased to welcome Donna Skelly, the councillor for Ward 7 of the Bill Kelly Show, to talk about this. Hi, Donna. How are you doing this morning?
I'm good. Good morning.
Listen, before we get into that, there's a meeting going on tonight. I just wanted to spend a couple of seconds talking about this because it's going to be in your area at Sackville tonight, and it's got a lot to do with public safety because we've talked about this here on CHML about a number of shootings and reported shootings that have gone on. Some of them have resulted in injuries, some of them not, but the fact that there's gunshot and gunplay going on in some areas has a lot of people concerned. So what are you guys doing about this tonight?
Well, this has been brought to my attention, and I think that the issue is has the level of violence on Hamilton Mountain and in the city in particular increased, or is it a perception? But I can tell you in my time on council, and even I'd say in my time as a reporter, I don't recall the number of shootings, this many shootings on Hamilton Mountain, and it seems to be an increase in crime, but in more serious crime. We had a very ugly incident involving a young man who assaulted an elderly gentleman who was coming to the aid of his neighbor. And this man was brutally beaten. And I've spent time with him and his wife talking about the incident. So in light of all of these, and then a constituent who owns a business who was robbed, we started thinking, what can we do? Police respond and they say, our hands are tied. We've only got so many police officers to investigate these incidents. But whether or not crime is up, there is a perception that it is. So I asked both of my fellow councillors on the mountain, Councillor Jackson and Whitehead, if they would be interested in joining me and hosting a community gathering with the police to talk about it. Is it real? Just what are the facts? Are we seeing an increase in crime? Are we seeing a rise in violent crime? And what can we do to counter this?
Well, what are police telling you about this?
They aren't saying it's up, but you know, sometimes it's just because it's reported perhaps more often, or the occurrences are closer together. But they've gathered all of the statistics. Of course, they don't gather them according to ward, but they're gathering them according to areas of the city. They will be addressing that this evening, and they'll be sharing ways of countering this issue. One of the bigger issues, which is interesting, is I get more complaints about speeding than I do about anything else. But I am concerned about the number of shootings. I mean, we're talking guns in the city of Hamilton on Hamilton Mountain, and I just don't recall that level of crime, that type of crime, being as common as it has this past summer.
All right, so it's going to be at Sackville tonight. What time?
Sackville, 6:30 until 8. And we are trying to, you know, what it's like when you've got people and they're very passionate. So we're asking people to submit questions in writing so that it isn't, you know, just manipulated by one or the other. And I think these things can get very emotional. So we're going to be taking questions from the audience as well as allowing the police to make their presentation.
Okay, so that'll be tonight, and I'm sure we'll talk about the aftermath of that in the days ahead as some of the Hamilton Mountain residents. And it's open, by the way, to residents all over the mountain, not just in Ward 7.
And the other two councillors will be there.
All right, good stuff. Thanks for this. All right, now, about you abandoning Ward 7. You've announced now that, to the surprise of not a whole lot of people, that you're going to be the Progressive Conservative candidate for this new riding. Talk to us about how this came about.
Well, trust me, it wasn't easy. I really, really love what I'm doing on council, and I think I've been pretty active, and I'm very proud of the accomplishments in the ward itself and in pushing back on a number of the issues at City Hall and the status quo. When I was first elected, I said that I wouldn't be afraid to ruffle feathers, and I think I have. And I think, in a positive way, I think that we're now actually asking questions that haven't been asked in a very long time. In terms of the impact on my own constituency, I have a list as long as your arm on what I plan to do in the next, just this year, to January and then moving forward, other things that I want to work towards. I have absolutely no intention of sitting back and not pushing these issues. One of the biggest issues that's coming forward, of course, is the Hamilton Waterfront Trust, and that's in October. And that is something, I've got a binder that's, you know, honestly, it's about 2 inches thick of information that I'd like to find answers, questions that I'd like to ask and some answers that I'm seeking. And I've mentioned that I'm working towards, and we will be building a splash pad at Bruce Park in my ward next spring. The wheels are in motion. The thing I have asked is why it's so expensive, and I'm trying to push back on the cost that staff have presented. For example, it's up to $600,000.
And we understand that. I mean, you've talked about this on the program in the past, and those are Ward 7 issues. But maybe the greater issue that I'm hearing from people with this announcement and the speculation about this announcement is that you had made a commitment to Ward 7, and now some people are saying, wait a second, why are you bailing out and running in a different riding now in the provincial election? Where's your commitment to Ward 7?
I don't think I am abandoning my commitment, and I think that and the proof will be in the pudding. I'm intending on moving, you know, going through and following through it. It's in June of next year. The election is at the end, just past the end of the summer. So you're talking about October, months later. I have no intention of, I will be working hard. And I think that in the end, constituents have to judge me on my record. And I'm proud of what I've done so far, and I have no intention of stopping.
But here's the reality. Many people told me during the by-election, which you eventually won, of course, when Scott Duvall moved on to federal politics, that you had made the commitment that you were not going to be seeking higher office again. You were going to stay at municipal politics in Ward 7. What happened?
Well, we've got a criminal trial that's happening right now. We've got two trials, but one is a criminal trial that's just gotten underway. As I sit on council and I see some of the frustration with what's happening, whether it's our hands are tied in a number of issues due to what I think are ill-thought-out policies of the provincial government, you know, I realize that we can do so much at a municipal level, and you certainly can affect change, but ultimately the municipality does answer to and is governed by the province, and the decisions that will have a greater impact on the city do come from a provincial level. So I do believe that I can help the city on a greater scale at the provincial level. Was it easy? Absolutely not. And I recall those conversations. And I've had a number of people say to me, don't leave because we love what you're doing on council. But I've had a number of people say, look, I'm, you know, just this morning after the newspaper article in the Hamilton Spectator, I've already received emails from constituents saying, you've got my vote, and where can I put you can put a sign on my lawn. So, yes, there will be pushback, and I'm not naive. I recognize that. But I certainly am not abandoning the residents of Ward 7, and I've said as well, if I am unsuccessful, I don't plan on being. But if I am, I have every intention, like my counterpart, of running again and seeking office municipally. And I think at that point, constituents have to judge me on my track record.
But isn't that trying to have your cake and eat it too, saying I'm going to run for both elections?
Yeah, I guess it is, but I think most of the councillors who've done it, you know, whether it's myself, Councillor Partridge, who I will be running against in this particular riding, Councillor, any councillor who's sought higher office, I believe Councillor Jackson. So there are a number. I mean, it certainly isn't precedent setting.
No, and listen, I understand where you're coming from here, all right? And it's within the rules. I know some people take a philosophical point of view on this and say, well, you shouldn't be doing this. But the law states and the rules state that if you are a municipal politician, you can run for higher office. You don't need to resign your seat. And although I'm sure you're going to hear some people saying that, I'm not going there because you're right. Other people have done that and have aspired to higher office and in some cases been successful at it. Some have tried and failed and then gone back and been reelected. Some not so lucky when mm-hmm. it comes to that as well. But it seems, according to some of the emails and tweets I'm receiving today, a little self-serving to say, well, I'm going to run for both, because then it questions your commitment to either one of them at this stage. In other words, I just want to make sure I've got a job, and I'm going to see what I can do this. Where's your commitment to the provincial run, and where's your commitment to the municipal run?
Well, as I said, I don't know other than to suggest that you have to look at my track record. And so far, municipally, I would suggest that I'm very proud of it. I've accomplished a great deal, in my opinion. and I have no intention of not working very hard. And, you know, tonight is a prime example of a meeting that we've never had on the mountain discussing crime. We have a big announcement coming up this fall on an issue regarding accessibility that will have an impact right across the city. And it's generated through conversations I've had with constituents throughout my ward and throughout the city. So, again, all I can point to is watch what I'm doing and base your decision, those comments, on fact in terms of whether I am continuing to represent my ward, which I plan to do.
But at some point, though, Donna, you know this. I mean, you've run provincially before. The reality here is that you're going to have to start knocking on doors, and it's not your neighborhood that you're representing. You're going to another part of town to do that. How much dedication can you have towards your Ward 7 duties while you're running in another area?
Well, I mean, excuse me, I think that that would apply again to any person who is seeking higher office, Councillor Duvall, Councillor Partridge, Councillor Jackson. I mean, it's not precedent setting, and I think they were all
no, and they were criticized for it at the time right. themselves.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah, and all I can say to that, Bill, is I have absolutely I would never let my responsibilities shirk my responsibilities as a representative of Ward 7. I have a number of things that I hope to accomplish, and I will be accomplishing those, and I will get it done.
So what's the time frame now? I mean, you know, with this election coming up in June, at some point, are you running for the nomination? Have you been given the nomination? What's your status right now within the party?
I have submitted an application, and I've had my first meeting with the executive, which is mandatory for all candidates who are seeking election. I have not yet been approved, but I don't foresee a problem with the approval, but I will be hoping to get that approval in very soon. And then the nomination meeting is going to be held first week of October.
How long has this been in the works? Because we've been told from two of the other individuals that have expressed an interest in this riding, as for being the PC candidate out there, Nick Lowers and Dan Sadler, that they've been told by the party executives, don't bother, that we're not going to support you if you guys end up winning this thing. It kind of sounds as if this is predetermined.
I would suggest no. I think that there are hard feelings, not just in this particular riding, but right across Ontario. This is going to be, for the Conservatives in particular, this is going to be a very winnable race. And what that has done has generated tremendous interest from people who are seeking the nomination process. I have truly pondered this and not made up my mind for the very reasons that we're discussing this morning. I can tell you that I've had many people say, please run for, you know, stay with Ward 7, run for mayor, stay, we love what you're doing on council. And so it hasn't been an easy decision, and it hasn't been a decision that I've made. You know, it was very recent. I submitted my application, to be very honest with you, last week. And my first meeting was in the earlier part of the week. So it was 2 weeks ago that I submitted my application. And then on a Thursday, and then by the Tuesday, I was in for a meeting. So, and as I said, it still hasn't been approved. So it hasn't been, I know, speculation.
It's more than speculation. I mean, you've been present at town hall meetings with Patrick Brown.
And obviously there's
an affiliation there.
Oh, yeah. And regardless, I mean, I would be working for the party regardless, because I think it's something I believe in, and I believe that that we need change. And one of the things I had done was earlier this summer just brought together a number of people after the province announced that it was going to be raising minimum wage. And so we just had an impromptu meeting with a number of stakeholders across the city, and just to get to meet him. I mean, I would be working regardless behind the scenes in hopes of seeing a change of government. But that was not made up. And that was one of the things, you know, Patrick kept saying, we need candidates like you. We want, you know, more women. You're certainly a fiscal conservative. You've done a great job. We like what you're doing. So I've been getting, you know, a push-pull on both sides of this issue for months and months and months. So,
but you know, there's a problem here with optics in some people's minds, though, Donna.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this if you've been the handpicked candidate by the leader here, much to the chagrin of these other two individuals that wanted to seek the nomination in a quote-unquote democratic process. It seems to be another example, and not the first one, of Patrick Brown trying to manipulate the nomination process, which is exactly what you're vilifying the government for doing.
Again, I would say that whatever happened with the other candidates, there are reasons why certain candidates are permitted to run and not permitted to run. I am going through the process. I'm not any different than the process that the Liberals just went through picking their candidates. There is huge interest right now right across Ontario. The candidates are lining up. The Liberals are struggling to find candidates. The Conservatives have people who want to run for them, and they have an obligation to ensure that the people who are running represent the strengths and the goals of the party and the party leader. I think that there is a huge problem, to be very honest with you, with nomination processes. I don't think that they work. I don't think that they're democratic, and you can, you know, you have all kinds of groups that can manipulate the process. There's often, I remember covering the Sheila Copps Tony Valeri nomination process, and it was pretty ugly, and there were allegations of fraud, and this is the kind of thing that goes on all the time. The process is flawed, and I think that you have to ensure that as a party leader, and as a party, that you're allowing people you want who represent your objectives to run in these processes.
Well, that's a topic. Meetings. Yeah, that's a discussion for another day as we go through that
but
process itself.
But it is an important discussion.
Oh, well, absolutely it is. And I know we'll have that in the days and weeks ahead as we move closer to this election. Donna, we're just about out of time this time around anyway. I do appreciate you taking the time for us today, though.
Have a great day. Enjoy the sunshine.
Ward 7 Councillor Donna Skelly. Back after this break, The Bill Kelly Show, 900 CHML.
You're listening to The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on AM 900 CHML.
There's been a lot of talk about Hamilton's waterfront development, what's going to be happening around Piers 7 and 8. And the city, of course, is developing a grand plan and looking for input and feedback onto that right now. But the same thing is happening in Burlington. Now, briefly, last week during the Mayor's Town Hall with Burlington Mayor Rick Goldring, we talked about the idea of what was going to be happening on the Burlington waterfront. There's a hotel plan for there and a proposal that's going forth right now. There have been some public meetings and some input into this, and it's become a very controversial subject. Mayor Goldring suggested that there was really no consensus for what they wanted to do there from the public input, but there seemed to be a lot of people with some pretty strong opinions. The councillor for the area, Ward 2 Councillor Marianne Mead Ward, was there, and she attends these public sessions. She got earful from both sides on this issue. She joins us here on the Bill Kelly Show to try to bring some clarity to this. Marianne, thank you so much for the time. It's good to have you with us again.
Great to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the waterfront. You guys are the envy of an awful lot of communities because of what you've done with the Spencer Smith Park and some other developments around there. But there seems to be a great deal of controversy, rather, about this hotel proposal. What's happening here?
Well, the site in question already has a hotel on it.
Yeah,
it's called the
right.
Waterfront Hotel, the old Travel Lodge. It's at the foot of Brampton Lakeshore, right beside Spencer Smith Park. And when the city was writing its official plan many moons ago, it recognized how significant that piece of land was and said that before any applications for redevelopment could come forward, there had to be a special waterfront study with extensive public input and a stakeholder committee that I sit on along with a number of others. So that's what we're in the middle of right now, is that study. It's been ongoing for about 6 months. And, you know, you mentioned that there's a lot of controversy or there's no consensus. In fact, there is consensus around one thing, and that is that people want more green space as part of this redevelopment, and they want any buildings to be scaled back from the lake and back from the park. They recognize how special our park is, and you know, I believe that we can achieve that goal of getting more parkland through this process, and that's going to be my goal. And the public has really spoken loud and clear on that. There's no controversy about that piece.
Well, and it's because we've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly of waterfront development in communities, haven't we, Marianne? I mean,
absolutely.
There are some cities we can look at, and I know everybody likes to bash Toronto for what they've done, and I think there's a lot of justification in that because theirs was done in kind of an arbitrary fashion, and you're right, it's a lot of glass and steel, and it can be argued that they've taken the waterfront away from the people in Toronto, and you don't want to see that happen. But at the same time, there's development proposals coming forward, and a lot of people want to live near the waterfront. A lot of people like to have condos where they can see the waterfront, or businesses that have that opportunity. Like, there's a great restaurant right there at Spencer Smith Park that does just that. How do you find that balance?
So the public want access to the shoreline. That's always been a key focus. It's been part of the waterfront trail and David Crombie's days, you know, is to actually give the public the opportunity to walk up and touch the water. And at Spencer Smith Park, we have that. Even on this particular site where the waterfront hotel is, the lawn, we call it the East Lawn in behind, is all already publicly owned. So that's fantastic. And I think one of our longer term goals in the city has to be looking for those opportunities to enhance direct public access to the waterfront. But as you say, people don't want the view of the waterfront blocked with condos or exclusively enjoyed by people who can afford to live there. And so we have to be very careful what buildings go along the waterfront. And people are also very protective of Lakeshore Road. We already have a lot of high rises on the north side. With this proposal and potential redevelopment, people are really concerned that what we're going to end up is a canyon of towers on both sides of Lakeshore Road. And you could be standing on that road, which is right near the waterfront, and not see the lake. And that we have to make sure we don't create that mess, which is what Toronto's been criticized for.
How extensive is the waterfront development plan that you've got here? We think automatically of Spencer Smith Park, and then I think everybody in their mind's eye can see this hotel that's been there for quite some time right now. But yep. does it go further up the shoreline as well? I mean, the places like Emma's and some of the other iconic places along there too, is that part of the overall plan?
It's not part of this particular study. But further east, the old Lakeshore Road area, that was subject to a previous plan, which itself was extremely controversial, that was going to allow height if developers purchased and gave to the city the actual shoreline land. And that's where Emma sits. There's a lot of private buildings right now that abut the shoreline in that area. And Emma's is a designated building. It's a heritage building. It's not going anywhere. And, you know, for a reasonable price, you can sit back there and have a drink and a meal and whatnot.
Been there, done that. I know that. But is there a desire to have some continuity along the waterfront then, Marianna, from one to another, as opposed to having breaks where you say, sorry, public, you can't go there?
No, I think the ultimate goal, my 50-year vision, is to have publicly accessible shoreline from Niagara all the way to Toronto and east of Toronto. I mean, we are on a magnificent body of water, a lake, and it feeds us, it gives us drinking water, but it's also very calming. It's a beautiful place. There's recreation on it, but we want to preserve that public access and get more of it. So the city is trying to develop what we call windows to the lake at the end of street ends, where we have, in my ward, recently put three parkettes down there. I want to connect those parkettes. The city decided about 2 years ago to sell some of those connecting pieces. I think it was a terrible decision. It was a 6-1 vote. We got to stop giving away the land we have, and we've got to look at ways to increase the public shoreline access that we don't have.
Because I know that that's a goal that's shared by an awful lot of people in that area. Because you're right. I mean, there are fabulous pockets there. There's Spencer Smith Park. There's what's going on down by Emerson further down. A lovely marina down by Oakville and places like that. And you'd like to think that you can have a green space or a corridor all the way along there in some way, shape, or form. Yeah. To make sure that access is there. But you do have the reality here of existing developments and existing proposals. And that's why I guess yours is maybe a little bit different than what they're doing in Hamilton right now, Marianne. Because, first of all, there's already a hotel there. But second of all, my understanding is the proponents already come up with a proposal here. They're saying this is what we want to do here, and you're commenting on that.
So they do have some ideas that they're workshopping as part of the study, and that's their right. They are part of the stakeholder group. The proposal that I was shown by the developer, he'd already developed some full color renderings of two buildings, one 30 stories, one 40 stories, with a connecting podium and some other features, and that's not going to fly. Nobody's going to support that. The public won't support that. The council won't support that. I don't think the staff are going to support that. The infrastructure simply isn't there. So so he can create pictures, but that's not what's going to, in my view, get embedded. What I think we need to look at is locating the buildings. They're right now, they're located to the west of the site with a giant surface parking on the east. We need to flip that and actually take out the surface parking. So if we put the buildings closer to the east end of the site, near the Bridgewater, which is currently under construction, we can keep the west part of the site as public green space at the foot of Brant Street. We can join it up with Spencer Smith Park and increase the use of that park. That, I think, is something that the public could get excited about.
What's the developer's attitude here? Are they playing ball with you?
Well, they're participating in the study.
That's a good first step. Doesn't always happen, as you know.
No, well, they are participating because they recognize if they want to get their own vision, they've got to be at the table. But the public's at the table, too. And we have a strong voice, and we have a unified voice on the issues around getting more parkland and green space and public amenities. There is no controversy about that wish list. And the mechanisms in terms of how we achieve it, that's where there's some discussion and different ideas. But I think the best way is to, my personal view, is to locate any buildings or structures to the east side of that site, and we can open up the west side and increase more parkland while we're respecting the existing development rights that already are on that site.
Obviously, we're talking about the hotel proposal and what may or may not happen on that particular site. But we would be remiss if we didn't look at a bigger picture here, too. And I know that in some of the discussions I've had with Mayor Goldring over the last couple of months, Marianne, there are other proposals for other high-rise buildings down in that general area within a block or two of that as well. Are you taking that into consideration as you're looking at the overall picture for how you want to see that area developed?
Well, I certainly do, and I think the residents do, and it's what we...
You can't do this on a one-off basis, can you?
No. Well, and the study area is actually beyond just the property owned by that developer. It does include to the north and to the east, and immediately to the east, and this was something approved in the 90s, is a 22-story condo, another hotel, 8 stories, and a 7-story condo right beside it. That was supposed to be, and it is designated in our official plan as a landmark, that was supposed to be the highest building in the downtown, and that was the one that was supposed to stand out. What we've seen since then is that has become, in a sense, a new minimum. We're seeing applications come forward for 26, 27, 22 stories, all in the downtown. And so there is a larger conversation that we're as a city looking at our entire official plan, including what's happening in the downtown. And I think people are just feeling condoed out. I think they're just feeling like this is just going to be a forest of high rises. It's going to be very difficult to live and to move downtown. And, you know, what's going to happen to the waterfront if we've got high rises on both sides of Lakeshore Road? Nobody wants that canyon. And people do want to preserve that character. We have some heritage buildings. We have, we still have a small town feel in pockets of the downtown, and people really don't want to lose that. You know, I know who my dry cleaner is. I know where I shop. I know the names of the people that own these stores. We don't want to lose that.
Well, you get the same thing going on just looking out your office window at City Hall right now, too. There's a proposal right across the street from you might suggest is incongruous with the streetscape there.
Absolutely. It is. And we have a workshop on Thursday where we're going to be looking at some preliminary proposals for the downtown. And one of the things that I'm pleased about is that they are recognizing that City Hall is a key civic landmark, and buildings that are around it should be smaller and should defer to that special civic place. And that is something that a lot of people agree with, that we want our prominent structures and our prominent buildings to be public gathering places like City Hall and Civic Square.
How much input is the public giving you on situations like this? I know some people that have been lifetime residents in that area, Marianne, and they're pretty adamant about maintaining the character there. But you also, of course, are enjoying, as many communities are right now, an influx of millennials and new people to the city of Burlington who might have different ideas. How do you meld those two mindsets together?
Well, I think they're more aligned than we think. And I've talked to a number of millennials, and there's a lot of mythology around what they want and what they believe. Millennials actually, when they start families, want to have want to have a ground-oriented house, we call it. They want to be able to walk out their front door. A lot of the millennials I talk want cheap rental. And the condos that we're building downtown are not cheap, and they're not rental. And if they are rental, they're very expensive. So we have a mismatch of what we think millennials want with what is actually being supplied on the market. And the more we build these high-rise towers, the more expensive land gets, and then it becomes very difficult to build any other type of housing like a mid-rise, like townhouse, like a single-family home. And we are at risk of eliminating the diversity of housing that makes a downtown or any community, for that matter, function well. We need families in our community. We need seniors to be able to live here. And if we simply build one type of housing and expect that everyone's going to move into that, we're kidding ourselves.
So this is happening, and these proposals are coming at you seemingly one after another, after another, after another. And at the same time, you're trying to formulate a plan for growth and control growth in a situation like that. Is one running ahead of the other at this stage? Do you feel as if you're trying to play catch up with some of the things that are coming over your desk now?
Well, I think developers have been kind of running our planning for some time in downtown Burlington. That's been a frustration that I've heard since I was elected in 2010. And it's something that I committed to ensuring a public voice and that we had reasonable and I'll call it gentle intensification, which is what we can have in the downtown. Our staff about 2 weeks ago, in response to all the pressure that we're getting to over-intensify, did a detailed intensification study of what we would need to do to meet our provincial growth targets. And we don't have to change a thing in our official plan to meet our existing targets. So if we choose to go above that, we have to have some pretty solid public policy reasons, like getting more affordable housing or getting diversity of housing. So we're fine. We're fine downtown. We can meet our targets. But that has always been the sort of the billy club that we've been hit over the head with, that the province is telling us we have to grow and our hands are tied. We choose how we grow, where we grow, how much we grow. And we've got to stop the over-intensification and have it be proper, because our infrastructure can't handle it.
Well, it's a criticism I've heard about other municipalities. I've heard about this from Hamilton and others down in Niagara as well, that what we don't need here are more rules and regulations. What we need to do is enforce the plan that we already have on the books. Is that the same for Burlington now?
Oh, absolutely. And I couldn't be more happy with the proposed changes to the Ontario Municipal Board. And I think, the province just has to get on with that and make it happen. That, before those changes, we're at the mercy of a board, one individual who steps foot in the town that they're making the decision, only to have the hearing. And the changes that they're proposing would put planning back into the hands of elected officials, city planners, and most importantly, the community voice. So they're talking about bringing those changes in the fall. It would severely restrict what could be appealed, and that's the direction it has to go to get back to true community planning. Otherwise, our plan isn't worth the paper it's written on, and the hundreds of thousands of dollars we're spending consulting with the community to build a plan will mean nothing if it can be blown apart at a hearing.
Is there a concern that this is going to progress and move forward before those OMB recommendations and modifications come into play?
Well, we're hoping those changes will be in place this fall. They announced them back in the spring. Certainly they better do it before the next election.
Well, the governments move at glacial speed anyway.
I discovered that when I joined. It's very slow. But, they've heard loud and clear that this is something that is necessary. There's no controversy about the changes, that there's a needed reform. Where the debate comes in is the development industry want fewer restrictions and the communities want more. And so far, the government is siding with the communities, and that needs, they now need to just move ahead with it, because it's a costly, costly endeavor to taxpayers and ultimately the province in time and in dollars to have this system. It is antiquated, and we need to get rid of it.
Well, it's waterfront development, and as we've come to find out, you only get one chance to get it right, and hopefully the tools are in place for you to do that in Burlington. Marianne, we'll certainly keep our eye on this as this unfolds over the next few weeks and months. Thanks for this today.
Thank you, and I would encourage the community to continue to weigh in. It's not over yet, and there's lots of chances to have your views known.
Amen to that. Thanks again.
Thanks, Bill.
Marianne Mead Ward, of course, the Council for Ward 2 in downtown Burlington, as they go back and forth about what's going to happen on their waterfront.
You're listening to The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on AM 900 CHML.
Of course, the story everybody's talking about today is, the comments from Donald Trump and the reaction from the National Football League. It's been fast and furious to suggest that the NFL and the players and a number of other people outside of football have thrown their support behind players who have decided to exercise their right to free speech and for protest. That's supposed to be what the U.S. Constitution is all about. It all started, though, the controversy, that is, when Trump made these comments this past weekend.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now. Out. He's fired. He's fired!
And on it went. And, of course, the crowd there just loved it. But the NFL, not so much. And the response from owners, players, and everyone else has been overwhelming. Scott Radley, the host of The Scott Radley Show, heard every weeknight at 7 o'clock. And, of course, the sports writer for The Spectator joins us to talk about this here on The Bill Kelly Show. How are you doing this morning, Scott?
I'm great, Bill. How are you?
Good. Your reaction as you were watching first of all, Trump's comments, but obviously the way the National Football League reacted. Give me your view on what you've seen.
I think the NFL has a massive problem on its hands right now. And while this may be flared up or exacerbated or grown by what Donald Trump said, and I certainly wouldn't have used the words or the phrasing he did, this is Donald Trump doesn't have to sell merchandise. Donald Trump doesn't have to sell tickets. Donald Trump doesn't have to boost TV ratings. The NFL's a business, and this is not a problem for him. This is red meat for Donald Trump. The NFL is looking at a situation right now where I really believe that this is a huge problem for them, and they don't know how to get out of it.
How so?
Well, look, I really believe wholeheartedly that many people, maybe the majority of people, when they turn on their TV to watch sports or entertainment or whatever, part of what they're doing is having a break from life. It's an escape. Sports has always been an escape. You know, most athletes, we always say, you know, an athlete isn't a hero. We call athletes heroes. They're not really heroes. Heroes are people who, you know, do really, truly heroic things. There's a separation between sports and real life, between entertainment, movie stars, and real life. And when you start to completely erase that line so that sports simply becomes another extension where everything has been politicized, everything has been turned into a I'm against you, and not in a fun sports kind of way, but in a life kind of way, I think that I really believe that it starts to run the risk of. And we're seeing it already. Ratings, whether it's this or other things, but ratings are dropping in the NFL. We're going to see what happens today with the ratings. Sports has to be that escape. And I'm looking at this going, it's not an escape now. When people turn in their TV, it's just another extension of a political rally. It's another angry, maybe that's the best word, it's another angry moment rather than an escape and sort of a fun brain break.
But where do you draw that line, though, Scott? I mean, are you suggesting that football players or baseball players or basketball players become oblivious to what's going on around them in you know, the communities in which they live and the things that are happening in the country? Do they just kind of put blinders on and say, well, it's Sunday, I'm just going to play football and forget any of that is really happening?
No, and that's the tricky part about this. I mean, listen, everyone will point to the fact that, you know, look at Muhammad Ali. And that's a great example of a guy who his political stance, his philosophical stance, it affected him, and it cost him years of his career. The argument, I suppose, could be, I don't recall. Now, Bill, you may remember this better than me. I don't recall. I don't remember a time when Ali in the ring after a fight or, made the political statements. There was Muhammad Ali, the fighter, who went in and he had all the fun with Howard Cosell and all the chatter. But his political stuff was separate. Now, he's still the same person. I understand that. But here, you've got a situation where the players have taken this in their uniform to the field. It becomes impossible to separate and say, well, that's his opinion that he or they are entitled to have off the field. But here that's on the
field. Why aren't they entitled to have it on the field too then?
Well, let me ask you this question. Are NFL players entitled to do anything they want when they're in their uniform on the field?
No, there are parameters. I get that. I understand that totally.
But the freedom of speech, the First Amendment, they can't. I mean, when Randy Moss dances in the end zone too much, he gets a flag. You could say that's my freedom of expression. The issue is, Bill, when you're wearing the sweater of a team, of a team owner, of an organization, you are now on the field. You are now at work. And so, listen, this is not, to me, necessarily anymore an argument about who's right in this one. It's an argument about, can the NFL continue to have this happen without it being a huge problem for them, ultimately, bottom line? Because while the people on each coast in the United States, which tend to side and believe and agree with Colin Kaepernick and with the guys who are taking a knee, that big swath over the middle of the country that all was red after the last election are looking at this saying, huh, well, then I'm just not going to be watching the NFL. And so it's not a question of who's right in this case. It's a question of, you are a business, and how can you possibly maintain your business when you have enraged, angered, ticked off, whatever, a massive chunk of your public that is supposed to be your audience.
But the NFL can't turn their backs on this. And this is the National Football League, and you're right, it's a business, Scott, but it's also a business that likes to pride itself and actually tries to wave the flag of being community-oriented and all about, you know, being part of what's going on in your city, whether it's Jacksonville or whether it's Boston or whether it's Los Angeles, etc. You've seen the commercials. You know, this is Billy Joe Bob, but he's also helping out at the United Way, or he volunteers at a food bank. They're cognizant of what's going on in social issues. So the NFL has gone down this road long before Colin Kaepernick took a knee a year or so ago. This has been part of their bread and butter. And the whole thing is if that's what they're going to do, then they better take the bad with the good. And the bad is that there's a lot of crap going on in American cities right now, and these players are part of it. That's their community. And if they want to stand up and say something about this, they have the right to do that. The president basically said, no, you don't. That you have to just be this lemming when you put your uniform on and ignore everything that's going on in the world and just go play football because that's all we want you to do. That's not free speech.
No, and Bill, you are entirely right. They have potentially, and again, I go back to the potentially only because, you know, this was something that when Colin Kaepernick took the knee last year, I really believe the NFL looked at this and said, okay, and didn't think it would probably necessarily go much further, did not see that it was going to become what it is now. But you're right, they have the right in the states to do this. The players have the right to do this. If they believe strongly in it, they are entitled to express themselves politically. That said, and let's go back to the business model, American people, also if they disagree with this, have the right to tell the NFL, I've tuned you out. I'm no longer interested. That also is their free choice. And this, again, I keep coming back to the business model for the NFL, why this is a problem for the NFL, not a problem for Donald Trump. The NFL needs people watching. There are $7 billion in TV rights that are being paid to the NFL this year. $7 billion. And if the numbers on TV start to drop, the TV rights next time they're negotiated go down, which means profits go down, which means salaries go down. So yes, the players can do this. They are entirely within their rights. They know also, they're not stupid people. They also know that if they decide that their rights tick off the buying public, it could eventually, bottom line, affect them. But that is still their right to do that.
Yeah, but you know as well as I do. I mean, people can threaten all they want. They're still going to watch football because they love football. And they may get ticked off in the first 5 minutes because somebody's kneeling at the anthem. They may decide at some point not even include the anthem, but it's not going to have a dramatic effect on the NFL. And by the way, I'm not defending the NFL as the people on the moral high ground here, because this reaction that they've had to Trump's remarks, which I think is justified, I think, you know, Trump's acting like an idiot again, what else is new? But the NFL is steeped in hypocrisy here too, because they're outraged about the fact that they say, well, we should have the right to protest. They were outraged that the president said you should fire anybody that does that. And then you've got, as you've mentioned, Colin Kaepernick, who started this whole thing, who's still unemployed right now because he's essentially been blackballed by the NFL because he's too controversial. So, I mean, these guys are certainly talking the talk, but they're not walking the walk.
You know what, Bill? There's so much to this. The thought that people will eventually just watch football again. Ratings for the last 2 years now, and you know, people say, well, this isn't Colin Kaepernick, and it may not be. This may not be. The TV ratings may not be directly related, but it is possibly coincidental that the ratings have dropped significantly in the past 2 years, roughly since the time he did this.
No, and you're going to try that into Kaepernick and saying people are giving up on football now? I don't buy that.
No, what I'm saying, Bill, is that there are, if you give people excuses, there are other things to do, and if you tick people off, look, Bill, if you come on the show, if you come on your show and you start taking positions that anger, that I'm not saying bother, that anger large swaths of your listening audience, some of them are going to say, you know what, I don't need to listen to Bill anymore. There's other things for me to do. I'm not saying, and the answer to, do people still love football? Yes, they sure do. Look, 2 weeks ago, or last week, I guess, not this last weekend, in Los Angeles, the Texas-USC college game filled the Coliseum in Los Angeles, filled it. The two NFL games that were played in there the weekend, or the next day, or the 2 days after, combined didn't draw as many. Now, there are lots of reasons for that, but I keep coming back. The NFL is not a league that it once was. It's not a bad league. It's not dying, but it's a league that suddenly something it has not had to do in two decades is actually think about its market. For two decades, it has been Teflon. There's nothing that could happen. Look at what's happened in the NFL with guys getting arrested and beating their wives and all this stuff. It had no impact. And suddenly, for the first time in two decades, this league has to begin to think about how do we maintain this. And this is a piece of it. I'm not arguing that Colin Kaepernick or these protesters are the only thing. I'm saying this is a piece of your audience that you are having to concern yourself with if they are saying, I don't need to tune in if all it's going to do is anger me.
Well, what kind of a commentary is that on the American people then, who, as you say, are maybe turning away from the NFL, that they're okay with violence against women, they're okay with NFL players that shoot each other, and are involved in illegal drugs? That's okay. We'll give these guys a pass. But if somebody has the courage to actually protest against the way minorities are being treated and against a president that is basically denying them their right, a constitutional right to protest, but that's the line that we're not going to allow that to happen. That I can't believe that American people would actually make that decision. But if that's what's happening, then God help them. If that's what the country's come to.
Well, because there's a pretty simple answer for that one, Bill, is that when NFL players, and it's not a nice answer, but when NFL players hit their wives or, as you say, shoot each other or get arrested for whatever, that doesn't really affect the fans. That doesn't really have anything to do with the fans. And we saw, you know, use a baseball example. When Barry Bonds was at his record-setting 73 home run season pace, everywhere Barry Bonds went, he was booed and he was hissed and people held up signs. But what happened in San Francisco? Well, he was our guy, so he's, you know, we're fine with that. We can overlook it. The flag thing, whatever the reason, I mean, the United States and the flag have a different connection. They just do than what we have up here. And you know that, and everybody knows that. The stars and stripes are a different animal down there compared to what they are here. And when you start to disrespect in the eyes of the public the stars and stripes, then you are affecting me. Are you really? I don't know, but that's the perception. Now you're doing something.
But everybody that takes a strong political view there wraps themselves in the flag and calls themselves a patriot. And I guess there are some people that are naive enough to fall for that. By the way, to your point about TV ratings, just as you and I were talking, I got this tweet from CBS Sports. Significant increase in TV ratings on CBS football this past Sunday. So, you know what? They're not turning away. Maybe as a matter of fact, they're getting some of those fans back.
They could be. They could be. We'll see if this persists over a number of weeks, because I say it's been 2 years of diminished ratings. Absolutely, you know, you can expect that on a day when there is this much attention paid to this issue, there are going to be a lot of people tuning in. I'll tell you one other thing, though, Bill, and I mean, I know we disagree on this in some cases. Where it really became interesting for me and where it really became a difficult issue for the NFL is when the guy from the Pittsburgh Steelers, and I'm drawing a blank on his name now, the team decided they were not going to come out for the national anthem. And the guy, an offensive lineman for them, who did three tours of duty in Afghanistan personally, decided he couldn't do this. So he was going to stand in the tunnel rather inconspicuously, but he was going to stand. He was not going to just say, I'm not going to stand for the national anthem. He now is getting crapped on. And so here's where, again, you end up with this political thing where football no longer, for a lot of people, or with this going on anyway, people are angry. Because here's a guy who served his country, and now he's getting pooped on because he stood for the anthem. It is my point of this whole thing, Bill, is the NFL has a conundrum on their hands, and it's a business conundrum, and it's a problem. They can't tell the players, you can't express yourself with your First Amendment rights. But they also, as long as this persists, there are going to be a lot of people. And I mean, this TV ratings, I believe your numbers. I think in the long term, you know, we can see the long range game has been a little bit different. This is not what the NFL wants. They may like their players to be intelligent, and so they should. And they may like their players to be engaged politically, community, all the rest. They should. This one is a dangerous game for them to be in. It just is. As a business side, as a league side, it just is.
As one of our listeners on Twitter just said here, seems to me that anybody prepared to stand up for people's civil rights is usually unpopular, at first anyway. And at that point, we'll have to draw an end to this one. We're just out of time. You obviously will pick up on this tonight, I assume, Scott, 7 o'clock tonight here on CHML.
We will be chatting about it, Bill, and you're welcome to continue. If you still have fire in the belly,
come on.
We'd love to have you. Thanks for doing this, Bill. Yes. I appreciate the chat.
Scott Radley, of course, 7 o'clock tonight on The Scott Radley Show.
The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on AM 900 CHML.